Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's always better to hear it live, this is a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. Enjoy our latest installment.
This is the most fun I've ever had talking about the Torah. Okay, I'm ready now.
Hi, welcome to the Park Avenue Synagogue Parsha Podcast, joined this week as we are for this summer with Camp Ramon the Berkshires and director Rabbi Ethan Linden.
Nice to be back. I am thrilled to be here.
We are really happy to have you. And today, as a real treat, Rabbi Jessica Fisher, newly minted Rabbi Jessica Fisher of Bethel Synagogue in New Rochelle. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. I'm so excited to be here.
It's amazing to have you. Just became a rabbi and you're already doing your first podcast. I had to wait 10 years after I graduated before I got to do my first podcast.
It's always been a dream of mine, so I'm eager to be here.
So I wanted to talk to you guys this week about something that actually began in last week's Parsha and then is continued in Parsha Pinchas that we read this week. And that's this disturbing scene where a couple is caught, an Israelite man named Zimri with a Moabite or a Midianite woman named Cozbi. And the two of them are, Ethan, how do they put it at camp? They're going for a Shabbos walk.
Yes, it's a spectacularly unsuccessful Shabbos walk. It ends as badly as any Shabbos walk could really ever end, I would say.
Sounds right. It's much worse than just being caught by the director.
Much, much worse.
So this man and this woman are going into their tent or going somewhere for a private alone Shabbos walk. And a priest named Pinchas is so enraged by this that he takes it upon himself to murder the two of them. And he skewers them. Now the backstory thing I forgot to say is that there had been a sort of plague of Midianite and Moabite women seducing the men of Israel. And because of that, God had brought an actual plague on the camp. And so in this moment, Pinchas thinks that he's ending the plague, which he does seem to do. But even the Torah seems a little bit uncomfortable with it. And we can talk about why in a second. I'm just going to finish the wrap up by saying, so this moment of violence from Pinchas ends the plague, but it actually then births an even larger moment of violence when the people go to war with Midian or Moab or whatever this grouping is immediately after. So I thought that, friends, we could tackle this really easy and cheery moment in our Torah, if that sounds good to the two of you. Should we dive in?
I think we should dive in. I want to start, Ethan, by asking you, it's interesting the way you put it, that you think the Torah is uncomfortable with Pinchas's act of violence here, because, you know, I think one of the things that's tough about this story is that I'm not sure the Torah is uncomfortable. Pinchas not only stops this plague that is ravaging the camp, as you pointed out, but he also receives at the beginning of this week's Parsha this Brit Shalom, this covenant of peace. And then, of course, the war that is coming at the end of the Parsha against the Midianites is very explicitly commanded by God as a vengeance against the people who have seduced the Israelites. So I think for me, as a reader, certainly as a modern reader, one of the things I find difficult about this story is that I'm not sure the Torah shares my discomfort with the act or with the act of vengeance that the people of Israel will visit on the Midianites.
Now, I agree to an extent, and I think that the Torah is definitely okay with God telling the people to go to war and with the war that God decrees. But I think that the Torah is uncomfortable with Pinchas's sort of vigilante justice. And actually, Ethan, the Brit Shalom that you pointed out is what I look at and see as part of the problem. Rabbi Fisher, you and actually, but we were talking about before this, you had brought this up. Do you want to explain sort of one of the sort of Gemara's read maybe, or the rabbinic read of this Brit Shalom and how it may be good or bad?
Yeah, I think one potential read of the Brit Shalom is that it's a reward just for a reward's sake, that God approves of Pinchas's behavior and therefore gives him this covenant of peace or potentially friendship. But then on the other hand, there's also the idea that maybe it's an implicit critique, that God's giving a covenant of peace to a person who was aggressively violent as a way of saying, okay, you did a thing that you needed to do, but now that that mission is accomplished, it's actually more important for you to be peaceful in this world.
I also think it's interesting that we don't really hear from Pinchas again, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but he is not, as we see at the end of the Parsha, the succession of Moshe is sort of begun, and we talk about Joshua, and we learn about him, and, you know, so Pinchas did this thing in this moment, but he's not someone to sort of idolize or turn the reins of power over to.
So I think that's interesting, Ethan, because, you know, one of the pieces of this story is that in last week's Parsha, when we were having this moment where Zimri and Cozbi are sort of heading off to do this act, and all of the other people seem to be engaged in this sin, you know, we get this glimpse of Moses and Aaron and some of the other leaders of the people of Israel kind of sitting by their tents and weeping and really having no sense of what to do. And into that leadership vacuum steps Pinchas. So one piece of this story is the kind of failure of the established leadership of the camp to check this behavior. And into that space steps this kind of zealotry in the form of Pinchas.
But at the same time, his zealotry almost saves the system, because he stepped in and did this really violent thing that was off the rails and out of the potentially sanctioned behavior. They were able to go back to having their normal system and their typical, their hierarchies.
So I actually think, Jessica, that's right. And I think that's both a very astute point and precisely what's complicated for me about this story, right? Because I do think the Torah establishes this act of Pinchas's as the right thing at that moment. And it's true, as Ethan says, that this is not the direction the community is going to go. This is not the leadership the community is going to have necessarily. But there is this sense in this moment that something out of the ordinary and really, frankly, pretty shocking was called for, and that Pinchas did what was necessary, which is, you know, a message that I'm not totally comfortable with.
And it's also a message that doesn't start with Pinchas. It's something that we actually see throughout the descendants of Levi and Levi himself. The Levites have this capacity for heroic and sometimes timely, but violence, and sometimes not heroic. But right, it begins with Levi when he and his brother murder the people of Shechem tricking them into circumcising themselves. But it continues through to even Moses, who is a Levite and whose introduction to all of us is a murder that he commits when he sees something that he thinks is wrong in a system that he finds abhorrent. And so he kills the Egyptian slave master. But there is this line that, and then goes to Pinchas, and these Levites have this righteous anger gene or whatever it is that they can kind of erupt when their sense of morality is offended. And it's actually one of the reasons the rabbis say why the tribe of Levi didn't get their own land within the land of Israel, but were made the priests who had to live in all of the different territories. Because the rabbis say that this sort of anger is something that is best to be, you know, sprinkled around. You need a little bit of it every once in a while, but you can't have an entire tribe of people like this. You know, the society wouldn't stand.
That's also something that feels a bit uncomfortable. I mean, I don't particularly like to think about the idea of an entire group of people that's characterized by the same trait, let alone a trait like anger. Like, who's to say that someone's going to inherit anger from their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents?
That's a really good point. And if we have any geneticists listening to this, you know, send us an email and tell us if anger is in fact an inherited trait.
No, I mean, I think it's a really interesting notion that, you know, if you're right and there's this kind of lineage of kind of Levitical zealotry, let's say, and I think your list of the acts was very good, and I would just add one, which is that after the golden calf, Moshe calls the Levites to him and they go through the camp and kill a whole bunch of people.
Right.
And, you know, again, I don't exactly know how to respond to this idea that there's this group of folks in our tradition who have a propensity for, and at times also a necessary propensity, at least from the Bible's perspective, to go above and beyond what is the norm in our judicial system, above and beyond what is the norm in our punishment system, and bring the community to heal. We know from the rabbinic tradition that the rabbis are a little bit uncomfortable, frankly, with Pinchas's act here, and they spend some time trying to justify how it is that Pinchas killed these people without any kind of judicial process, which, of course, anyone who's ever studied any aspect of the rabbinic judicial system would understand is something that they love. The rabbis love process. And the idea that this person, without any sense of process, goes in and kills these two people is very problematic for them. But again, I keep coming back to the idea, and Ethan, I think you sharpened the point even by giving your list of places where this has happened. I keep coming back to the troubling notion that the Bible seems to think that at times this might be necessary.
So the question then is, if there are places where the Bible seems to think this is necessary, and we could come up with probably a dozen more, are there instances where it also works to curb this? That is to say, are there times where the Bible itself seems to promote a different way, right? Is the system set up by the Torah? You need laws most of the time, and you need Judge Dredd, that's not a reference anyone's going to get, a vigilante sort of class that is empowered to, if they think everyone's getting too far out of line, go above and beyond and start making examples out of people. Is that what they want, or does the Torah give us in other instances visions of a different way of kind of orchestrating an orderly society?
Trying to think of a good answer to that question.
I was trying to tee you up for the Aaron thing.
I was going to say, that was the Rodef Shalom.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you say it that way, right? Because I don't think I think about the Aaron piece of this as like a different, as a contradictory way. I think the rabbis think of it as a complementary, or I think the Bible might see it as a complementary way. And of course, the Bible doesn't really portray Aaron as being Ohev Shalom for Rodef Shalom. That's something that the rabbis invent, right? So I'm like, if we're talking about the biblical piece, I think that the Bible is comfortable with the idea that occasionally you need somebody who's going to be zealous for God.
So maybe it's actually not that the Torah itself tries to cap its own vengefulness, but that the rabbis, the inheritors of the Torah that we follow, were uncomfortable. And so they spent time trying to curb its sort of more bloodthirsty instances, which we actually see all over, right? They undo the rebellious son. They undo the death penalty. They kind of try to take some of these parts of the Torah that we find really bad. Now, they could have done more. I'm not, defending them completely, but they are trying to maybe mitigate some of the more vengeful and violent tendencies that the Torah lauds.
I think the rabbis do that, and I also actually think in our parsha we have an example of another case of the inverse of curbing the vengeance, which is actually that God rewards Pinchas as a thank you for curbing God's own vengeance and violence and desire to be attacking and destroying the Israelites for their crimes. And instead God says, I'm holding back because of what you did. So it's support of Pinchas's violence, but also a diminishment of God's.
So that's really interesting, Jessica. So your argument there would be that this kind of brit shalom that Pinchas receives is really God's way of saying to Pinchas, I appreciate that you stepped in here and did something, because my anger was in some sense raging out of control, if we can sort of say that about God, and that Pinchas's act allowed that anger to be controlled.
Yeah, and I think while really gruesome, I would imagine that God's unchecked anger is much more dangerous on a global scale, both to the Israelites specifically, but potentially to the actual globe, than Pinchas's one violent act.
Right, and I guess to me, and this is a question that I think about a lot, is, where do we come down on this, right? Do we think in this moment that we're living in, or really in any kind of human moment, are we of the opinion that there is a place for that level of righteous anger. Maybe not murder. I think we would all kind of pause at the idea that we should go out and be killing people. But do we think there's a place for zealotry in our discourse, in our protest, in our world? And are there moments when that zealotry can actually lead us to a place that is more stable rather than less?
I mean, I think you just asked the million-dollar question. You know, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago that specifically talked about this. And they came down, I believe, if I'm remembering it right, as saying, yeah, that a little bit of righteous anger can be a good thing as long as it doesn't push you out of control. The rabbis, I actually think, agree with this. And the word that they use for this righteous anger is the same word for to rise or arouse, and can be used in a sense to think, well, how do I know something is wrong? How do I know in my heart, right? One way is that I have books and I have ethicists and I have a tradition that's going to tell me something's wrong. Another way I know is that I look and I just feel this anger at something in the world that I think is wrong. And by following our own sort of internal anger sometimes, and when we know that it's this righteous anger, again, not necessarily, as you said, acting upon it, but it can help to be a kind of a moral compass in a sense of thinking about, you know, what brings out the ire in us and how we can then work constructively to fix the situation.
You know, it's interesting, Ethan, as you were talking, it occurred to me that you asked earlier about kind of, does the Torah have a kind of alternate path here? You know, it doesn't take necessarily murder, but how do we get ourselves back to where we were supposed to be? And it occurred to me as you were talking that, of course, the Bible does have an entire alternate path that does not involve killing, at least not as the starting point. And that's, of course, the entire tradition of the prophets. And the prophets are nothing if not righteously angry most of the time. And the whole point of their anger is to get people to see where they have gone astray so that the final punishment does not have to fall. Now, one of the things that's tough about saying that, of course, is that the vast majority of the prophets right. in our Bible are failures,
right.
right? And I think it's a strange irony that the most successful prophet in the Bible is Jonah, and he is the prophet that is the least righteously angry, at least not at the people he's prophesying to, because he doesn't really care about them that much. And of course, he's not prophesying to Israelites at all. But I do think there's a sense that what you're saying is right, that some sense of just this kind of blazing anger is supposed to be the kind of thing that wakes us up. The problem is that the Bible seems to suggest that it rarely works.
Or taken to its maximal sense, it doesn't, right? If you just stand on the walls of the city and shout at everyone about how horrible they are, then you're not going to change anything. And so maybe there is this idea that the righteous anger needs to fuel righteous action. And only in that way will it work. Because otherwise you're totally right that the prophets are relatively ineffective. And these acts of sort of vigilante violence that we've pointed out seem to be incredibly effective. And so it's that it continues to be somewhat problematic. Jessica, what do you think? Is there a role for righteous anger in our world today?
The word that comes to mind when we're talking about righteous anger is rage. I feel like right now I'm reading a lot and talking to a lot of people who use rage as a way of saying this is actually acceptable kind of anger, because rage is a tool that can be used for something greater. It's a big feeling. And my sense is that, like in the story that we're talking about, it's complicated. Sometimes rage or righteous anger or whatever you want to call it is a tool for good and a tool for change that is necessary and important. And sometimes rage can be damaging both to the person who is feeling the rage and to whatever the object of their rage might be. And part of what we need to figure out as a society is how to negotiate those two and how to create space where rage can be healthy and shared in a productive way that allows for us to change and move forward as a community.
That's a beautiful idea. And it takes me back to the Iliad. Right, we're not the only tradition that grapples with this idea of this fundamental problem of human rage. Rage is actually, by the way, what you made me think of this is it's the first word of the Iliad is manen, which is Greek for rage. And the entire poem is about the rage of Achilles and how it is at one and the same time effective, inspiring, terrifying, and destructive.
I also happen to be a big fan of Marvel Comics. And I've been watching Luke Cage recently because I haven't watched that before.
Yes.
And I think one of the things that all of those movies and TV shows do a really nice job of is investigating the role of vigilante justice and where it's helpful and where it's harmful and the blurry lines in between when they can be really damaging, but also when they can be saving, you know, different neighborhoods or different communities or societies or whatever it is.
And I just want to say that we have now gone from the Iliad to Marvel Comics, and I feel very much in the presence of giants here. I have no good reference to make to this point, so I feel bad about myself now, and I feel a little bit of anger as well.
Well, the whole point of Judaism is just to make you feel a little bit bad about yourself, just a little bit.
So I actually think what both of you are saying is really interesting. And there's this notion, I think, in both of the sources that you're talking about, that anger can be an extraordinarily positive force, or at least a motivating force towards the kind of change that is needed, or towards heroics in the case of the Iliad, but also can obviously be something that can consume us and can end up with a result that is not what we intended. And the problem with rage, of course, is that it has that tendency to burn so quickly out of control. And I think a lot about this question that Ethan, you mentioned earlier, which is what happens to Pinchas, right? Pinchas does not become a hero of the people of Israel and certainly does not become a hero of the rabbis. And I think the question that we keep coming back to is, if we think of Pinchas not as a person, but as a kind of symbol of the moment when rage takes over and we do something that's beyond what we should do, but that works. And the question is, what do we do with that emotion? What do we do with that inclination that we have to just let ourselves fly off the handle and do what feels good in the moment and might even work in the moment, but ultimately might be more destructive than constructive? And I think in some sense, the question of the Pinchas character is not so much about his act in that moment, but about the question of what does a decision made in anger do, not just in the immediate moment, but in all of the moments that are going to come after that.
Yeah. And Ethan, actually, even the, not thinking about the moment that comes next, but also how it's going to affect everyone, because in some sense, maybe the fact that Pinchas's act of this vengeful violence is followed immediately by this war, maybe it's about God being just as angry and vengeful and condoning the violence. Maybe it's actually about the infectiousness of this vigilante violence. And when the people see Pinchas murder a Midianite and get a reward from God, they then say, well, we all got to do this. And so they rush off to war immediately after. It's this sort of infectious nature of the sort of violent act.
So what you're saying is that when Pinchas attempted to restore order through his violence, what he actually did was incite more violence.
Yeah, it seems like that. You can make an argument that that's the case.
Which goes back to what Ethan was saying about not thinking things through. Like, you think your rage or your anger is going to get somewhere productive, but potentially continues to have devastating consequences.
Jessica, I think that's actually a really interesting point. And now we've kind of gotten to a place where we've talked about how, on the one hand, it seems like anger, righteous anger, that sort of indignation that leads to perhaps a slightly extreme position or act, can be productive. And we've also talked about how that sort of anger and indignation that leads to an extreme act can be very counterproductive. And before we jumped on the podcast, Jessica, you were talking about how you actually saw in Benot Tzlafachad, the daughters of Tzlafachad, which is also in this parsha, a kind of counterpoint to this whole conversation. I wonder if you're willing to just bring that out, because I thought it was really interesting.
Sure. I think the story of Benot Tzlafachad is these five daughters of the man named Tzlafachad, who were really upset and angry and enraged, truthfully, that to find out that they wouldn't inherit land in their father's name. And to address their anger, they went directly to Moses and had a conversation with him about what they thought would be right and justified in their situation. And Moses then went and took that conversation to God, who approved that they should, in fact, be able to inherit land in Israel, even though their father had died. And I think it's an important counterpoint to the Pinchas story of where the directions that anger can take us in and the potential outcomes, because the result of their petition isn't violence or anger on behalf of other people, but rather it becomes a communal norm for everybody of how land inheritance might work in the future.
So Jessica, what I think you're saying there, and what I love about your point, is that in some sense, the Torah is giving us, in kind of the way that Ethan spoke about earlier, is giving us these kind of different paths by which to change communal norms, and ultimately putting its finger down on the scale, as it were, for the path that was taken by Benot Tzlafachad, right? That this idea that they were angry and upset, and they were had right to be. They were righteous in their indignation, and yet their solution was to challenge the authority, but not to break out in some kind of act that would have lasting consequences on their ability to be inside the community.
Yeah, and to your point about the short fuse of anger, it seems like they thought through their plan and thought through the consequences in a way that Pinchas, in his moment of anger, didn't take the time to do.
I think that's amazing. And if you don't mind me just making an addition to your beautiful drash, you know, Pinchas gets Brit Shalom, but of course the daughters of Tzlafachad get something that lasts even longer because their inheritance will now go forever. And there's something deep about the idea that their reward will outlast them and will outlast their children, and in fact will become a part of the inheritance of the people of Israel.
And the beauty of the Parsha is that it contains everything that the two of you are talking about. We see in Pinchas this example of righteous anger, and we're asked to sort of evaluate it for ourselves. It is quite effective. It also seems somewhat problematic, and there is a place for this anger in our world. And there might be times where we see anger, or we see something in the world that makes us angry, and that what is called from us in that moment is anger and taking action into our own hands. But we also see the disastrous effects of that anger within this parsha. We're also given this other way. We're given the actions of Aaron, who the rabbis say is a man of peace. So a Levite can be a man of peace as well as a man of anger. But we're also given this example of Benot Tzlafachad, where the system can be used to make the world more just, not just for the people in question who are feeling the anger, but for their descendants, for the other women around them, for everyone. And so in one parsha, we see these examples because in our lives, there are going to be times where anger is called from us, and there are going to be times where we are asked to work to make a system less oppressive, to make a system more just. And we, by keeping both examples alive in our Torah reading, we're able to keep both examples at the ready whenever we should need it. All right, guys, thank you so much for joining us. Rabbi Fisher, it is a pleasure to have you, and hopefully we will have you again. And, you know, for people in the know, Rabbi Fisher has also actually been a teacher at Park Avenue Synagogue for the last couple of years through the Study Circles program. So it's nice to have you with us once more. And Rabbi Linden, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us. For everything for this summer, and we'll see you next week with another discussion and another guest.
Wonderful. Thanks for bringing us both on. And since you claimed Rabbi Fisher, I will also say that Rabbi Fisher worked at Ramon the Berkshires for a couple of years and was an excellent Rosh Tefillah last summer.
It's great to be here with both of you.
All right, guys. Bye, everyone. And thank you for listening. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you for listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. See you in shul.
arousal.